From Troy Public Radio, this is In Focus, and I'm Carolyn Hutchison. Today we launch a summer book series that we're calling The Storyline. And we start with a conversation by Skype with best-selling author Jonathan Eich. His book, King, A Life, delves into the backstory of Martin Luther King Jr. and the trajectory of social change that he led. We concentrate on Dr. King's Montgomery connection and how it shaped his mission. Jonathan Eich, thank you so much for joining us from New York.
Thank you.
I want you to take us back to his office in the parsonage in Montgomery. There's a picture of Gandhi in there. How did King receive his calling from God?
Well, you know, King grew up in the church. His father and his maternal grandfather were both preachers, and so it's no surprise that he would go into this line of work. But it wasn't until he got to Montgomery and found himself thrust into this position of leading this bus boycott that he really first describes hearing the word of God, where he felt like God actually spoke to him and told him not to worry, that he could go forth and lead, and that this was what God wanted him to do. And that was a really crucial moment in the young King's life. He was only 26 years old, remember, when he found himself leading this bus boycott.
And on page 166 of your book, he talks about the significance of Montgomery in that calling and in his work. Can you share that paragraph?
He wrote, "The experience in Montgomery did more to clarify my thinking on the question of nonviolence than all of the books that I had read. Living through the actual experience of the protest, nonviolence became more than a method to which I gave intellectual assent. It became a commitment to a way of life."
So among the new discoveries that you made about his life, what stood out?
What really stood out for me was the fact that he was uncertain. You know, we think of him as being this great leader, this great American hero, but he had doubts, he had insecurities, he suffered, you know, at times from anxiety. In fact, even before the night of his most important speech in Montgomery, the speech where he really introduced himself to the people of Montgomery, he had a panic attack. He had 20 minutes to write that speech. And after 10 minutes of a panic attack, he basically gave up trying to write something and pushed himself out the door and decided he was going to have to improvise. I was just really struck by the fact that King, once you really look into the details of his life and once you talk to people who knew him, he emerges as a much more human figure.
Why was he so convinced that nonviolence was the way to achieve civil rights?
Well, it was complicated. You know, he had studied Gandhi and Thoreau and others in college. But when he got into Montgomery and the boycott began, that's when it began to become clear that the commitment to nonviolence gave him a kind of moral higher ground. He was able to position himself, and the black people of Montgomery who were staying off the buses and walking to work every day were able to assume this moral authority by saying, "We are so committed to this cause that we will suffer for it. And even if that means suffering physically at the hands of our violent tormentors, at the hands of the Ku Klux Klan, we will not strike back. We will prove that with our love, we deserve a place in the American fabric. With our love, we will prove that we are as good as anybody."
There are a couple of phrases in your book that encapsulate that. One is victory without violence, and the other is pacifism added moral clarity. And yet, as the civil rights movement evolved, there were a number of organizations and people who kept clamoring for violence. Who were they?
Well, there were plenty of people who felt like Martin Luther King was weak. They confused his pacifism with weakness. And King maintained that it took more strength not to fight back. But that didn't satisfy everybody. And there were plenty of people who said, "Yeah, I'll march with you, Dr. King, but if somebody hits me, they're going to get punched back." And then there were others like Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, who insisted that black people needed to defend themselves and that the only way they were ever going to get the respect of white authorities was to pose a threat. Dr. King thought that there was a very different kind of threat that they could pose, that they could throw a moral threat without necessarily a violent threat.
And the gossip in that era was that he was either a communist or influenced by the communist philosophy. What did you find out in your research?
You know, there were a lot of former communists involved in the civil rights movement. But then again, there were a lot of former communists all over America in the 1950s and 60s, former communists with ties to presidents. So that's not shocking because the Communist Party of America had a lot of influence, especially in the 40s and 50s. King had very close advisors who did have communist ties, but he had no interest in communism. He felt like he was trying to make American democracy better. In many ways, his true patriotism was overlooked because what he was really saying is that we don't want to tear down America. We don't want to junk the system. We want to join the system. We want to make it a more just and equitable system for all.
What was his relationship with President Johnson? You talk in the book about J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director, well known for getting dirt on people or information. But what about President Johnson?
We know a lot more about the relationship now because of the release of these new FBI documents and the release of the tapes that Johnson made from his White House. And one of the interesting things is that when Johnson takes office, he calls King right away and tells him, I really want to work with you. I need your help. And he calls him Martin. They have a really friendly conversation. Gradually, that friendship really begins to fall apart. And you can hear LBJ starting to call him Dr. King and Reverend King. And a large part of that is because J. Edgar Hoover is feeding Johnson steady information with memos about King's personal life, about his ties to communists, about his opposition to the Vietnam War, an area where LBJ is very sensitive. And both men really seem to enjoy spying on King and gossiping about his personal life. So the relationship is really undermined. What in many ways was the strongest relationship between an activist and a president in American history really came undone because of the work of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI.
You paid tribute to Coretta Scott King, and you said in the book that her courage matched her husband's.
It's true. And in fact, I think that's the main thing in the beginning, at least, that really attracted Martin Luther King to Coretta, is that she had more experience as an activist than he did. She went to Antioch College, an integrated college, and was active with the NAACP and with protests on campus. And when they met, King was really excited to find somebody who was as passionate as he was and who even had more experience. But because of the roles of women in society at that time, and especially the way that Baptist preachers viewed the role of women, she was really relegated to housekeeping and raising the children, and she was frustrated by that. Nevertheless, she continued to push her husband and continued to get out on her own as much as she could, at least, to join the movement.
Reading your book, there are eerie similarities to what is happening today. Expound on that.
You know, we're still struggling with the idea of whether Black history should be taught as part of American history. We had celebrated the centennial of the Emancipation Proclamation when King was alive and Kennedy was in office, and there was a lot of debate about how we should teach the Civil War. Should we teach the idea that this was a battle between two equal sides? How much of the war was actually fought over slavery? The same questions that we're hearing today, really. Also, some of the things that King talked about as he gained fame and moved beyond Montgomery, you know, he began to talk about the fact that racism in the North was just as bad as racism in the South, that segregation in the schools was just as bad in the North as it is in the South, and those things are still true today. King talked about reparations. He talked about police brutality. Many of the issues that he addressed still haunt us today.
It is an epic book, and thank you, Jonathan, so much for being here with us. Because in this month, we have Juneteenth coming up.
That's right. There are still so many great stories from our history that we need to learn. And this history is our history. It's not just Black history. It's all of our history.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Thanks for doing this.
Joining us by Skype for our summer book series was Jonathan Eig, author of King, A Life, about civil rights leader Martin Luther King, Jr. Jonathan Eig will be appearing Thursday, June 8th at 5:30 p.m. at the Dexter Avenue King Memorial Legacy Center in Montgomery. Thanks for joining us today for In Focus, which is now a podcast on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Carolyn Hutchison, and this is listener-supported Troy Public Radio.